Hello, everyone. Logging Heads Nation, this is Eli Lake of the Washington Times, and I am joined with Heather Hurlburt, Executive Director and Grand Ayatollah, Supreme Leader of the National Security Network. How are you, Heather?
I got nothing to follow that with.
Grand Mufti.
We're here,
it's Foreign Policy Friday. And where do you want to start off? Do you want to talk about Sudan?
Well, yeah, Eli, you had an interesting article on Sudan this morning, and I think, A, people aren't talking that much about Sudan, and B, it's kind of an interesting window into some larger phenomena. So, yeah, let's start with your Sudan article.
Okay, well, I wrote a piece that was looking at the tension between Susan Rice and Scott Gratian, Scott Gratian is the president's special envoy to Sudan, and Susan Rice, of course, is the president's special ambassador to the UN. And unlike certain cabinet members like Bill Gates or Hillary Clinton, Rice and Gratian really are in Obama's inner circle. They were part of his, very close-knit group of foreign policy and national security advisors during the campaign, and clearly two people who I think, really have the trust of the president, and they really do disagree about how to approach Sudan. And I think in some ways it is indicative of the tension in the Democratic Party right now between Gratian, who I think is taking a kind of realist approach and is taking the view that, I can call this a genocide or say it's not a genocide, but what really matters is getting the government to allow humanitarian aid organizations the access to the independent, the IDP camps in Western Sudan. And then I think there's Susan Rice, who has, for most of her career in public service, going back to the Clinton administration and the NSC, has taken, in my opinion, an admirably tough line on the government of Omar Bashir. And she is very uncomfortable with, I think, some of the engagement of Scott Gratian. Now, I might add, there's clearly the two of these two people also really do like each other. In fact, Scott Gratian, in his testimony at the Hill yesterday, went so far as to say that Susan Rice was one of the only women in the world to whom he would say, "I love you." That's a quote.
Yes, I saw that in your piece.
He proclaimed, "I love Susan Rice." So I don't want to imply that this is a blood feud, but there is a policy disagreement.
Well, Eli, the first, what I think is so interesting about this, and of course it's not just the Democrats, the Republicans are split in the same way, and this is a debate that, this is a divide that crosses both the parties, and I think it's a rare case of where you can see in public the debate that I think this administration is struggling with internally on just about every issue. And that is the sort of, you called it realist idealist. I think another way of thinking about it is kind of activist, non-activist, where, the frustration on Sudan is it's very easy to sound activist, and it's been harder to find activist steps you can take that will actually sort of make a difference. And so you have a continuum that starts with the activist community outside, where you have a very successful effort to build up an NGO community on Sudan, but that's predicated on the idea that there are simple actions that you could take that would make everything better, where unfortunately it turns out to be much more complicated than that. All the way over to a community that says, Sudan, it's a tragedy for the people involved, but we don't really care. And, the fascinating thing is that actually Gratian and Rice have much more in common with each other than with either of those extremes. And so what I think you see sort of spilling over in public here is actually a tactical debate, not a strategic debate, that both of them would put a lot more focus on Sudan than maybe a lot of other people, both inside and outside the administration, would. But, there's this American problem that we like to see ourselves doing something. Like to feel good about sort of the moral stands that we take.
Well, I think that there is, though, it's a significant debate. I mean, General Gratian yesterday said that he opposed having or designating Sudan on the list of state sponsors of terrorism.
Well, and he said it should, I mean, I found that sort of surprising that somebody would go up on the Hill and say, yeah, right, it's just a political designation.
Right. And then there was no evidence that they were involved in exporting terrorism, according to our intelligence community, which I might add is something that Senator Feingold disputes and other people would dispute as well, though. Certainly the Sudanese government has been cooperative with the CIA on counterterrorism, but I think that Susan Rice, who is responsible for, in many ways, the designation of Sudan and a lot of the sanctions that Scott Gratian bemoaned, disagrees with that approach. And while I agree with you that I think that they are coming at this as two people who care deeply about Africa and care about trying to get the situation better in the ground in Iran, so it's not like it's a debate between one person who thinks, I don't care about Sudan, and another person who says, we need to do something. That is true. But there's a huge gap, I think, between their approaches. I think that Scott Gratian is willing to sort of basically say that the government of Omar Bashir, which is now indicted for crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court, should basically get a skate if it's willing to, at this point, do the right thing vis-a-vis the Comprehensive Peace Agreement with the South, and also in terms of allowing access for humanitarian aid organizations to the Darfur and the independent, the IDP camps. And I think that someone like Susan Rice, who saw this regime do what it did, is saying, you mean, so now it's okay to displace 3 million people and destroy however many, you know, hundreds of villages, and there's really no consequences at this point in terms of the international community? I mean, she's balderdash, you know?
Well, this is the really fun part of this discussion where I go all realist and Eli goes all idealist. But
that's how it's always been, though.
not always. But so that where I think they both come together, but which is in some ways an awkward place, especially for Susan to be, is that, you know, the administration's position is clearly that if we can, in fact, get the Sudanese to do all the things we want them to do, we would let the sanctions go and we would sort of swallow hard. The disagreement is over whether, as Gratian said yesterday, you need to concentrate on carrots or you also need sticks to get them to that point.
Yeah, sure.
But there's nobody inside the administration. I mean, there are definitely people out there in the advocacy community, but there's nobody inside the administration saying, you know, we have to punish the Sudanese government, even if that makes it worse for the people on the ground. And that's, you know, going back to my point about the problem with sort of American rhetoric and policy that we love. I mean, we all love the idea that evildoers are punished, but that isn't usually, frankly, policy-wise, how it works out. Or, you know, we have to wait a long time for the arc of history to bend and punish them.
Well, Susan Rice, when in the March, I guess when the International Criminal Court indicted Omar Bashir, she put out a statement saying, bravo, International
yeah.
Criminal Court. And, you know, I mean, it's an irony that Democratic administrations tend to like the International Criminal Court and the Treaty of Rome, and Republican administrations don't. But you know.
So, Eli, can I actually just interrupt you? Because
yeah.
I think there's another point where I sometimes think we overlook the ways that these kinds of policy disagreements are actually useful, and that's a great example. So the ICC issues this indictment.
Right.
Everybody says, oh, no, this is going to be a real problem because the Sudanese government is going to react by kicking out all the aid workers, and actually things will get worse for the folks
right.
on the ground, which, in fact, is what happened.
That is what happened.
Susan issued the statement saying this is a wonderful day for international justice, which it was.
Right.
Gratian then went in and worked his tail off doing, you know, very unsavory negotiations with the regime to get the aid groups back in.
Right.
Now, you might argue that that's actually on net the best, I mean, short of Bashir actually being delivered to The Hague in cuffs, that that's the best outcome you should have hoped for. And, you know, so in some ways, although it's always uncomfortable, in some ways it may, this division may actually work out usefully. So I think I try to take a very, I mean, this is the same way I often feel about disputes between Congress and the executive on foreign policy, and maybe that makes a good transition point to some of the other topics on our agenda, which is where you have these divisions, you know, just use them to your advantage.
Well, I mean, yeah, I agree with you that it's actually we should be able to walk and chew gum, but I would say that from the perspective of a policymaker, there are people who focus on the integrity of the ICC, right? And they want to see that this is an organization that isn't just sort of a paper tiger, and that there really are consequences when the ICC indicts you. So those people, I think, would be very wary of meeting with President Bashir or having Scott Gratian meet with President Bashir, because that would really undercut in an important way and would be exploited by the Sudanese government in a way to saying, well, you know, this indictment really doesn't mean anything. And then there, I think, are people who are just looking at the welfare of, you know, the people, the 2.5 million people living in the IDP camps in Darfur, and they're like, well, if Grayson needs to spend 45 minutes with Omar Bashir, and that's going to mean that we're going to be allowed to build a road from Chad to get, you know, important, you know, medical supplies into these camps, well, then I would take the tangible benefits. And so I think that there are times when there is a kind of conflict, because I would imagine that Susan Rice and a lot of people, a lot of Democrats, would want the ICC to mean something. And yet at the same time, everybody, of course, would want to do as much as they can to help the really vulnerable populations in Darfur. And I think that that requires sometimes, you know, hard choices.
Yeah, I mean, just sort of my last comment on this is that, you know, the both blessing and curse of being as large and wealthy and influential a country as we are is that we can have a government that pursues both of those objectives at once, and then we have to have a leadership that can sort of adjudicate between them. And I think, you know, what you saw yesterday, that I'm sure people at the NSC who pride themselves on these kinds of disagreements not leaking out into the public are not happy about this morning, is, you know, that sort of both agendas are being covered admirably, but the seams showed a little bit in public. And that, I thought, was interesting because, as I said, debates very parallel to this are going on inside the administration about closing Guantanamo, about Iran, about Afghanistan, about Iraq, and in a way that's really unprecedented for at least 8 or 10 years. They really are being fought out inside, and people are getting to express divergent opinions, you know, quite far up the chain, all the way to Obama. But this is the only issue, really, where the disagreements have spilled out very much in public.
I mean, there were massive disagreements in the Bush administration. I mean, there were.
I wouldn't try to dispute that there.
There were, like, huge. There was an internally fraught administration with whole agencies and departments at times in open rebellion. So, I mean, I would say that there were. I mean, it was an example of how not to manage diversity of opinion. But and certainly, I mean, I'm still of the mode that the Obama administration is really politically, like, disciplined and professional.
Uh-huh.
So I put it in a rare kind of first instance of one of this. And by the way, my senior administration official, who I quoted in the piece, got back to me saying that, you know, we overplayed the debate and it really wasn't the two people clashing, and it's true that Scott Gration really does love Susan Rice and Susan Rice really does love Scott Gration. I think all of that's true. I mean, we'll have to wait for Woodward's first book, I guess, you know, to find out, you know, who really has the long knives out. But
Somehow, I don't think that little stunt is going to be repeated with this administration. But it does. It's interesting, Eli, because I remember the summer of 2001. Actually, I was sitting in a job in D.C. just a few blocks from where I'm sitting now, and I remember the great speculation was, when is any kind of disagreement going to seep into the public eye? It's an interesting sort of historical parallel that in the summer of 2001, the Bush administration looked like the most disciplined shop ever. And there was some incredulity among many of us about how no policy disagreements had come out in public at the time.
I picked up in 2001, before 9/11, on some disagreements. In fact, I'm trying to think, I will never find it, but I did write a UPI story about how there was a huge disagreement about Iraq policy with Richard Haass on one side and Wolfowitz and others on the other side, and it turned out to be correct. Anyway, but we can. Do you want to move on to Iran?
Yeah, let's talk about Iran a little bit, because I think we may not be disagreeing enough here.
Well, I don't know. I mean, are we going to disagree on Iran? Because I see right now a regime ready to negotiate. I mean, they've just given every signal that they are just willing to sit down at the table and cut a deal. You know, I mean, they keep arresting these journalists, which is, everybody knows, the international signal for mercy, we give up. Right. They just stole an election. I have no reason to believe, like, it's crazy to think that this regime doesn't want to talk, right?
You know, that's interesting. I read it a little differently, and first of all, it looks to me as if the regime is so busy internally that it doesn't actually know quite what it wants to do externally. And then second, you know, it also seems to me that I don't know what they want to talk about. And the signals that you're picking up here in Washington are not that. I mean, there's an interesting contrast. the administration seems fairly confident that they're going to get some movement out of the Israelis and Palestinians in the next month or so. Not big movement, but little movement, sort of enough to inch forward. You're not getting signals that suggest that they think they're going to be going anywhere with the Iranians anytime soon. So I would question your analysis on that.
I'm joking a little bit. But, I mean, listen, at this point, what's different post-June 12 with Iran is that you have, as clearly as possibly can be said, Mousavi, Shireen Ebadi, and an opposition that has won the solidarity of Democrats and Republicans alike, Americans and Europeans, and really, as we watched these demonstrations and we watched them getting crushed, all said there should be no negotiations with the coup d'etat government, and that if you were to negotiate with the coup d'etat government, their words, not mine, that you would be undermining our position internally as we try to, you know, take back what was a stolen election. And now you have people like Khatami and even Rafsanjani hinting that there should be some sort of referendum. And, you know, there have been talks about having a referendum on the Islamic Republic's constitution for some time. Maybe this is just a referendum on the powers of the supreme leader or the presidency. Who knows how it's going to necessarily shape out. But, you know, the notion that at this point, I think it would be so politically difficult for President Obama, and I certainly don't, I'm not one of these people who saw what, I thought President Obama was, it was probably, I don't know if it was, I don't know, I mean, there have been stories that Hillary Clinton was more kind of hawkish than Obama during this stuff, and had, you know, Nick Kralov, our State Department guy, wrote this very interesting piece that she wanted to kind of bang the Iranians, you know, sooner than Obama did. But whatever happened, they kind of got to the right place. They said, listen, the whole world's watching as you do all this stuff. And it's true. And I just, at this point, think that what we're seeing is a pattern in Iran where they continue kind of to peel back the layers of the onion. And the last layer that just got peeled back and turned into the opposition because of the kind of hard revolutionary core of the regime were people who people who were original revolutionaries, like Mousavi and Rafsanjani, are now finding themselves, you know, sort of out of power. So what's left is not a group of people, I think, that can cut a deal. That's my sense.
Well, Eli, we need to back up to something you said initially, because I challenge you to provide a link that we can then provide to the viewers where either Mousavi or Shireen Ebadi says the United States and Iran should not be talking about Iran's nuclear program right now, because I just don't think that's happened.
They said no negotiations with the coup d'etat government. They've said that many times.
Put the link up.
I'll be happy to.
Because I actually, you know, a lot of what you said I agree with, but the thing that I think people have to keep in mind is that the core, you know, yes, it would be very, very much preferable to have a rule of law government in Iran that that represents and respects the wishes of the Iranian people, but it's just not the case that if you change, you know, Iran's strategic interests don't change. Iran's sort of position in the region doesn't change. The fears Iran's Arab neighbors have of it don't change, and vice versa. So the idea that there's somehow the possibility of a scenario where our security concerns vis-a-vis Iran are dramatically different is just wrong. And I also, you know, from a purely political perspective, it would be very difficult. You know, there was some thought back before the elections that, in fact, if Mousavi had won, it would be much more difficult for someone who was perceived and branded as a reformer to negotiate with the U.S. because he would be constantly accused of being weak, and that any kind of compromise that would be acceptable to us on sort of nuclear oversight, reintroducing the IAEA, stopping the militarization programs, would be much, much harder for someone who's already perceived as a reformer and westernizer to implement than somebody who was perceived to be a conservative. So there's two different tracks going on here. One is the U.S. wants the reform movement in Iran to succeed because we favor freedom and democracy and the rule of law everywhere, and we oppose regime violence everywhere. That's one track. And then the question is, what can we do about that? And the answer is not all that much. And you know, there's been a lot of ink spilled over that. And as you said, the administration has gotten to the position of lending what moral support it can while being careful not to do anything that allows Ahmadinejad to run around and say, see, the opposition is being propped up by the West. So that's one track. The separate track is you have the problem of Iran's nuclear program, Iran's support for Hezbollah, Iran's destabilizing activities in Iraq, and how those impinge on U.S. security interests and those of our allies. And you have the question of what deals can be reached with Iran that will cause those to be more manageable, to be corralled over time. And those are two different channels.
No.
You shouldn't conflate them into,
no.
Oh, you know, if Mousavi becomes president of Iran, everything will be great.
I don't think that simply Mousavi becoming president of Iran is that everything is great. But I just don't. I think that I go by this following maxim: the people who are terrorizing their own people are also terrorizing the world, and that the argument that somehow they would be able to act in their own national interest and there's a series of incentives and disincentives is just to ignore history and is fanciful because, you know, there has been an effort to offer very generous incentives to the Iranians from Javier Solana through the track that was supported by Bush to Obama's own diplomacy before the election. There has been an effort to try to deal with this sort of hardcore of the regime. And the truth of the matter is that these two things are very deeply connected because in order to maintain the rationale and justification for an Islamic republic that has now kind of transformed into a Stalinist dictatorship, you need to have constant vigilance against an external enemy. And you also need to, and that is, and so these two things go very much hand in hand. I disagree. I think that Mousavi, if he had been allowed to win the election, which, you know, it's no one's ever going to know what the vote count was, but clearly the numbers were somewhat inflated to avoid it. I think it's fair to say, avoid a second round and so forth. But it's, I think, a little bit beyond that. I mean, I've been saying for a while there's a legitimation crisis in Iran, and now it's really come through. And I'm saying that everybody who is somewhat reasonable is now barred from power. We saw this beginning in 03 and 04, but it's really kind of the revolution has truly eaten itself. It's sort of, you know, I mean, and at this point the people left are, you know, I think they might be rational within their own revolutionary logic, but to kind of keep pretending that there's a deal and that there's things that we can say and that there's some balance and is delusionary. And I think that it's not me just saying that. It's not neocons saying that. It's like Sarkozy saying that. The Europeans have been trying to get a deal with the Iranians for some time and to convince them that they do not need to have a nuclear weapons program and continue to support terrorism and all of these things that we want them to stop doing, and they have not shown any interest. And the people who looked like, who used to be the argument that, well, if we could only get to the kind of more rational actors in the regime, have now been, you know, stripped of power. I mean, when Rafsanjani's daughter is briefly arrested and you see, like, you know, aides to Mohsen Razavi's children killed in prison, which we have in the paper today, things like that, Heather, I just think it suggests that the what's left is the rump of this revolution. They're not going to negotiate with evil infidels like us. They're not going to give up their nuclear program, whereas you would have a chance if you had people who I think that, I guess I'm saying that the rational elements are in the process of being purged right now.
I mean, Eli, I don't disagree with you about what's going on inside Iran. So then the question comes, the U.S. has very, very, very tiny points of leverage over what happens in Tehran. And frankly, they're mostly negative in terms of there are things we can do that make it easier for Ahmadinejad to hold power. There are things we can do that unite sort of nationalist support around him. And so the first key is not to do those things. And then the second key is to do things affirmatively that force Ahmadinejad to reveal himself again and again to be to be an autocrat, to be not fully rational, to be placing his own sort of narrow vision ahead of the survival and welfare of the society as a whole. And frankly, holding out the prospect of negotiations is a great way to do that. Because why would the guy not engage?
I didn't argue that we shouldn't hold out the prospect of negotiations. I mean, I think that's somewhat clever because, you know, you let them stew. I just don't think that there's... I'm just making a more basic point, which is that there's not going to be any... Negotiations aren't going to get anywhere. And I'm also... I think
10 minutes ago, I was actually the one who said that there, nothing was going to happen on Iran, but...
No, I mean, I guess what...
I do have to back up to one other thing, which is about the Europeans, that with all due respect... Why should the Iranians come to a deal with the Europeans? Because the Europeans pose no threat or problem to them. The Europeans have no real leverage over them without us. So
Okay, for years in the Bush administration, there was an argument that was made, which I thought was somewhat wrong, but that Bush never really supported the European, which I think he did. And, you know, when you send Welsh to a year ago to meet with them and saying, listen, here's our deal, this is me, we're breaking our old rule, and there was almost a deal with Larijani that we now know from, I guess, the BBC series on Iran and the West. So there were a lot of efforts that, at the time, you know, were not noticed by some of the critics of the Bush-Iran policy. But all that fair, now we have a new president. And he has made it abundantly clear at some, you know, you could argue some domestic political risk to Obama and that he was going to get attacked as being soft and so forth, as a Democrat might be, saying, hey, we want to negotiate. And they still say no. And then they do this. And my point is more just an empirical one about the nature of the regime that is left, or the IRGC state that is left. That, you know, we're well beyond. And I think that there are things, maybe not that our government can do, but I think that, like, Shireen Abadi has called for a protest of Nokia, for example, based on part of a story that I wrote, I think, first on the Nokia Siemens network selling a monitoring center to the Iranians. There's a lot of really advanced material that the Iranians would like from Western companies, a lot of German companies, that, you know, treat them like the, you know, the apartheid era companies that dealt with PW Bota. Mm-hmm. There are things that people can do that can make it very difficult and show their solidarity with the Iranians. Okay. Finally, you know, the nature
and
of these people.
If I'm right, there's a bill going through the Senate now, based on that, which is I had the real question, though, whether anyone outside Washington, I mean, has actually noticed this, and I thought the point of trying to make Nokia and Siemens pay a price for that was a very interesting and valid one, and I just was curious about whether there were any indications that anybody anywhere had actually taken it up.
I'm glad you asked, Heather, because I wrote a story about how Siemens could lose out potentially on a lot of contracts with LA Metro.
Yes, so hint to our California viewers. I thought that was very clever of you, Eli. I appreciated that.
Yeah, so I would argue that, you know, now is the time to treat Iran. You know, I shouldn't be arguing because I'm a reporter, but I'm saying that while maybe you're right about the levels of efficacy of direct American diplomacy regarding the people power movement or the stirrings in Iran and the Iranian opposition, there is a whole lot of stuff that just regular Americans can do. And now's the time to sort of think of the Iranian regime that's sort of there at this point as the way we thought of pre-Mandela South Africa, or rather pre-de Klerk South Africa, which is that they're a moral pariah, and that anything and anyone who wants to do business with this government at this point would pay a price because, you know, frankly, the actions of the last 2 months in particular, but over a long period, really do shock our conscience and you know, so forth.
All right. So just to sort of draw these themes together a little bit again, what I want Obama to be able to do is to say, you know, as the person who controls the levers of government power, you know, my job is, on the one hand, to be prepared to negotiate an agreement that gets safeguards put over Iran's nuclear program, and on the other hand, to have measures in place to safeguard ourselves and our allies and our troops in the event that can't be done. And I want him to be able to go to the Iranians and say, look, I can do a deal, you know, I can do a deal anytime. On the other hand, we're a democracy, and I don't have all the power over all the levers in my society, and if you persist in behaving this way, well, shucks, you know, popular outcry is going to prevent corporations from doing business with you, and ultimately, maybe it's going to prevent me from making a deal with you, because, you know, guess what? We have more than one lever of power in our society, and that, you know, that to me is the perfect place to end up.
Yeah, and well, I would add one more thing, that if there are, by some reason, some, you know, if there are negotiations, right, you could see a gambit where, you know, seeking legitimacy, the Iranian regime facing more pressure from home would want kind of to have the show of a negotiation to show that, look, even the Americans accept our existence. That part of those negotiations has to have some sort of Helsinki third basket, because the detente talks with the Soviets did not really get us anywhere in the 1970s, but it's when you started seeing American negotiators like Max Kampelman really pressing the issue of the Soviet refuseniks and political prisoners and so forth in Eastern Europe, that you really did, I think, start to see a kind of the effective mix of all of the elements of national...
Well, actually, Elias, as somebody who spent 4 years working at CSCE, yes, you're conveniently honing in on one chapter of the story that you like. But if you hadn't had, that's a great example, because if you hadn't had the security negotiations in the 70s, you couldn't have had Max Kampelman. You know, Max was, and lots of other people too, who the human rights negotiators were totally a product of what came before, and they were a product of being willing to sit down with some really noxious people, do some security deals, and frankly listen to really spurious sort of charges about things that were wrong with the U.S. society. They were the product of a really complex project that had some aspects to it that were less than pleasant from an American idealistic point of view, but it was exactly the willingness to engage on. And, you know, there was a great outcry that somehow talking to the Soviets on security issues was going to hurt us in some way. And, of course, we can look back and see that it did them a lot more harm than it did us. So I actually think that's a great example of how, you know, engagement it doesn't hurt us. It doesn't affect our military planning. It doesn't change our strategic resolve. And it shows the other side that we have confidence that our system is going to endure. Well, I think that's a great example.
When we just had security talks with the Soviets, and we didn't have the human rights element, we had the 1970s when this kind of approach really did. I mean, it led to you know, it was not the 70s overall. The arc of the 70s was not a good decade for American national security, as evidenced by the Soviet invasion.
But Eli, you couldn't. You know, Kampelman and the human rights negotiations only happened in the 80s because you had laid the groundwork in the 70s.
Well, that's true. In 76, they added this third basket under Jimmy Carter, who was concerned about human rights largely with our allies, but less so with our adversaries. There was little that was done, but it was at the end. It was at the beginning of Reagan, where Reagan emphasizes that, hey, there's this other basket of our diplomacy. And I'm saying that, yeah, you're right, that it starts in, I think, 76 is when they decide that they're going to have this
75, and actually, interestingly, it was done by Congress, and that the pressure to add the human rights basket came from Dottie Fussell and Millicent Fenwick.
Nice work.
Two names from the history books that you can, and that,
right.
So Millicent Fenwick was a moderate New Jersey Republican, Lord, how we miss them. Who insisted that there needed to be, that there were, you know, issues besides security issues that needed to be addressed, that we shouldn't forget
right.
about the sufferings of peoples inside the Soviet Union. And, you know, frankly, as you said, took a lot of ridicule from our allies, from people inside the U.S., and, you know, spent the first 8 or 10 years really getting nothing,
right.
but laid the groundwork, along with the willingness to have the security discussions. So
right.
comprehensive approach.
Well, I'm saying but don't make the mistake of the Nixon administration and say the only thing or the mistake of Chris Hill, which is the only thing we're going to talk about with the North Koreans is going to be the nuclear program, because when we tend to only talk about it, and those are the terms of the blackmailer, and when we only talk about security and we don't talk about human rights and other issues, then the negotiations end up becoming, you know, when we know the Soviets cheated in the beginning, you know, when it was just security, and we know that North Koreans obviously have, you know, not lived up to their verbal agreements to be charitable to Chris Hill. And at this point, and so my point is that I think that sometimes there are people who would say, nope, what we care about in Iran right now, what's really in our national security interest, is the nuclear stuff. And I don't disagree. I think the nuclear stuff is really, really important, as much as I'd like to see democracy in Iran. But you're not going to get traction on the nuclear issue unless you broaden the scope of it. So I think we might be agreeing here, Heather, in a weird way. Is that right?
I mean, I think we're both agreeing that actually the administration is doing a good job of dangling the carrot and appearing reasonable while also criticizing what's actually happening on the ground.
No. I meant if there were negotiations with Iran.
Well, I think we also agree that we're not holding
I wasn't saying that. I was saying if there were negotiations. But
yeah, I don't do counterfactuals.
All right, Eli,
have to jump back to my day job at this point.
As do I.
And okay. As you know, I totally disagree with you on Chris Hill, but maybe we'll take that on next time.
Oh, come on. Like the North Korea. What has happened to those negotiations?
The North Koreans have decided that it's not in their interest to participate in them. And I don't think it's because we weren't talking about human rights. But okay, leave that for next time, Eli.
Okay.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.